Wilson, who is most recently the author of Flat Screen. Adam, how are you doing?
I'm great. I'm doing well.
Yes, I'm glad I can get in touch with you right before you're actually getting on a plane.
Yeah, no, it's good. I hate flying, so...
Oh, you do? Well, what's wrong with flying?
Aside
from the security theater and all that. No, aside from the sort of defenseless position you're put in.
Yeah.
Aside from the lame snacks that you get. Well, I'm sorry. I don't want to be negative here.
Yeah, you sort of hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, yeah.
Although, I do love Ativan, so it's sort of a...
Okay. Well, let's get into the book. I actually wanted to broach the TV question from a weird angle. One of the items contained within Will Self's half-serious, not really serious, rules of writing, he has this on his list. Remember how much time people spend watching TV. If you're writing a novel with a contemporary setting, there needs to be long passages where nothing happens, save the TV watching. Now, I know that you once worked as a TV blogger for FlavorWire.
That's true.
There is a notable televisual influence, down to the
Definitely.
Parenthetical details, in Flat Screen, that is often so striking that one, in fact, even encounters Eli's mom sleeping on the sofa in a slanket. So, I'm wondering, do you have any pragmatic ideas?
The slanket was actually a period detail.
Ah, yes.
Just
that's
not
true.
Go off topic too much. But
I'm sorry to be so out of touch.
But I will say, the slanket was the one thing that I had to change in the book because I originally had it as a Snuggie, but the book set in 2006,
yes.
And the Snuggie was not yet on the market.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But the slanket was. It was sort of the precursor. I think Snuggie has since taken a monopoly on the armed blanket.
Armed garment blanket
yes.
thing. I mean, slankets do seem... No, they do seem very endurable, the slanket, I have to say. So maybe I think they just seem to last, like, plastic that's not going to biodegrade
yeah.
or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But I wanted to
anyway,
get...
Anyway, sorry.
No. I thank you for the clarification. It's very important to get the slanket in the period detail right.
A nice might be that I think I learned of both items in infomercials.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, the question I have is how novelists can win over readers from television, and you know, do they need to follow this advice that Will Self offers of writing long scenes describing watching television? To what degree was the process of writing Flat Screen your way of contending with your own television feelings? Clearly, we touched a nerve here on the slanket thing.
Sure,
so
yeah.
let's just sort of get the ball rolling here. Do you need to specialize also in these short alternating chapters? But that's a lot to throw at you. So go for it.
I don't think necessarily.
Yeah,
I don't know. It does seem like a ridiculous rule. It's Will Self's rule seems almost the opposite of what you're probably told in most writing programs.
Yes.
Which is to, you know, have set up conflicts so that your characters can move around rooms and
yes.
pick up objects and
yes.
stuff like that. But, yeah, I don't know. I think more so I was just interested in a character whose worldview has been so shaped by television, perhaps in the way that mine has, or in that people of my generation, or even the slightly younger and probably a slightly older generation too,
yeah.
Have, you know, I sort of like the idea of having this guy who's kind of poorly educated and, you know, didn't pay attention in school, didn't go to college, but at the same time, he actually, you know, has quite a lot of information available to him, kind of all... based on the fact that he's watched an incredible amount of television, and that, you know, I like this idea that, you know, if you actually, you know, spend days just watching the Discovery Channel and the History Channel and the Nature Channel, but also, you know, the news and CNN and old movies on AMC, that you sort of can become this kind of Renaissance man of knowledge, and in that you know about all sorts of different things without having any kind of deeper understanding of any of them.
So the couch potato is a superficial Renaissance man?
Yeah.
That's all America has to offer these days?
Well, I don't know, but... You know,
we were trying to win these people over so they dive into libraries. I was hoping you, the guy who managed to synthesize this into novel form, might have a few ideas here.
No, I have almost no ideas.
Oh, okay.
On that front.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think we're losing the battle.
We are losing
sadly.
The battle. But it is marvelous, nonetheless, to watch this cultural phenomenon mushroom as it is.
Sure.
Yeah.
Although, you know, then again, I have received, you know, I sort of did have this idea that, oh, you know, maybe people can relate to this because we all spend all our time on the internet.
Yeah.
And, you know, watch a lot of movies on TV and stuff. But then I've gotten all sorts of, like, criticisms on Goodreads and from bloggers complaining about how this guy just sits around and watches TV and doesn't do anything. So maybe these people who are complaining about the book are like living these rich lives that the rest of us don't, you know, aren't experiencing, and they're sick of reading about characters who aren't. So I don't know. They probably wouldn't like Will Selves' books much either.
Yeah, that's true.
That's my guess.
That's true. Well, I'll get into the Goodreads reviews later, because I actually checked them out too, but I wanted to sort of get into your book before we actually did that.
Sure,
you know, you have this strategy of alternating chapters throughout the book. It kind of relates to what we're talking about here, where you'll have something short followed by another Eli episode. You know, the first two parts of the novel have these bulleted lists. You have things such as facts about my mom, ways in which I am like a rapper.
That's one of my favorites.
Good, I caught the right one. But the third part shifts to all these possible endings, and then Eli starts to reference these narrative terms near the end, sitcom, C-pilot, C-plot, things like that. So I'm wondering to what extent these alternative chapters were almost a series of bona fide notes to help you better know your character and your book. How did this tension between the self-reflective and almost the self-aware narrative occur during the course of writing this book? I'm curious.
I think, you know, it happened in a few different stages.
Yeah.
Originally, the book was quite a bit longer, and I felt it was bogged down. I felt it was sort of, it was a bit slow, and that there were two things slowing it down. One is that there was a lot of, you know, time spent relating backstory and sort of, you know, things about these characters, childhood memories and all this type of stuff that I felt was really slowing down the pace of the book, because I knew I wanted it to have this really quick pace. And maybe part of that is trying to appeal to readers who, you know, have low attention spans. But
well, this leads me to wonder, did the bulleted lists come from the larger draft that, where one would normally expect that kind of thing to come from a notebook, these were details you plucked from... Oh, wow.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I wanted to figure out a way to kind of speed it up without losing a lot of this information. And so I thought of these kind of lists. And so I ended up cutting about 100 pages from the book and replacing it with, you know, all of these interstitial chapters that I hoped were doing some of the work in a kind of fun and more entertaining and quicker way.
Yeah.
That felt right for the character who is reading blogs and who is, you know, it felt like it worked. So that was one thing. And then as for the endings, those in part came out of, you know, one thing I think the character Eli is struggling with in the book is this idea that everything, all his points of reference come from television and movies. And he sort of has this idea that he wants to, you know, he in the classic coming of age mode wants to kind of grow and sort of become a real person, maybe, whatever that means, and you know, live some kind of grown up life. But his imagination, I think, is sort of has been compromised in some way, because I think everything he can imagine is something he's seen in a movie or on TV.
Sure.
And so he doesn't quite, and he has bad points of reference in terms of his family. He can't look at his father and say, I want to be like that. And so instead he looks at movies and says, well, I could be like that, but is that realistic? Or is that even a possibility? Or has it gotten to the point where, you know, American life is really just a kind of imitation of these tropes and these sort of received cultural narratives.
Yeah.
And I think Eli's struggle with that reflected my own struggle as a writer to try and, you know, write a book in a genre that's been done a million times and sort of come up with a kind of narrative that is at the same time aware of all that's come before it and doesn't sort of cop out and have an ending where someone drives off into a sunset with the perfect song playing. And so, the way I kind of battled that was to have Eli himself sort of imagining all these endings that he's seen before. But then they don't just come all at the end, they sort of come for over the last 100 pages. So I think each time one is presented, you know, my hope is that then with the book continuing along, it's sort of... that ending is kind of passed over.
Yes.
And that, you know, it's sort of pointed out as being ridiculous or unrealistic or cliche or impossible or all of these things, and then life continues to go on in the book. So,
but he's also trying to find an ending while all these other things are happening.
Sure,
to him as well. Which also made me, I have a total wonkish question for you, but the whole incident on the football field with the Viagra.
That really happened to me.
That really? I was going to ask first and foremost, you know, what is your Viagra experience? And second, I mean, that also seems to remind me almost of Frederick Exley's A Fan's Notes. I wondered if that might have been a possible non-book.
Oh, yeah. Fan's Notes, I think, is one of the books I've read more times than any other book.
Yeah. And of course, he talks about reading other books multiple times. Was that like a touchstone for you in terms of like reading and stuff?
In my life, yeah. It's funny. I didn't think of it that much in terms of when I was working on the book, but I had, you know, it's a book that's been really important to me in my life.
Yeah.
And interestingly, I think in that book, one of his touchstones is Saul Bellow's The Adventures of Augie March.
Which I also know is a big influence on you.
Which was in some ways a big influence on this book, too. So, maybe it all kind of comes together. But, Fan's Notes is great. I just did a piece for FlavorWire on my 10 favorite slacker novels.
Oh, yeah? Exactly.
I think my favorite thing about that book is it introduced a great piece of slacker furniture that I'd never known about, which is the Davenport.
Yes. So there are all these little clues of furniture that almost doesn't exist anymore as well in there.
It's a perfect slacker item, I think.
Well, it makes me also wonder if flat screen is in some sense, I mean, we were talking about it being set in 2006, whether it's more of a historical novel as well. Like, maybe your Davenport is perhaps the Slinkin.
Yeah, I think so. I'd like to think that.
Yeah.
If I have one, you know, if I leave one thing in the world, it's to put the
into
the history of American literature.
We need more writers to do that. I also wanted to ask about, you know, I know that one of the main reasons you went to Columbia was because you were a huge Sam Lipsight fan. And
yes,
for me,
definitely.
This book seemed a really weird bastard hybrid of Homeland and Portnoy's Complaint. And then I found, after I had figured this out, that you wrote an essay for J-Book, Portnoy and Playboy Go to Summer Camp, and you confess that you read Portnoy at the age of 13. So I'm wondering at what point Eli's Jewish identity entered the equation for you. Because in that essay, you also point out that you have a certain queasiness to Roth, to Woody Allen, to Larry David, and so forth. I mean, you describe this as a feeling of repellent, yet ultimately satisfying queasiness.
Yeah.
So if Eli's Jewishness possibly allowed you an entry into the sort of the comic novel, the portly protagonist and so forth. I mean, you know, I'm wondering if you could talk about this, how this
sure.
came to be.
Well, it was certainly something I was aware of in the sense that I was very nervous that I couldn't, that the book had to somehow not, I was really concerned that the book not be just an imitation of Portnoy's Complaint, which, you know, I think.
Or Homeland and Stanley Ullman.
Yes. Which I think in its early sections it was much more so. You know, and I remember actually my first workshop at Columbia, the teacher, I brought in an early version of the first chapter of this book, and she had brought in Portnoy's Complaint, and she's like, I think this is more, you know, sort of a better version of what you're trying to do.
Wow.
But, you know,
give up what's been done before. Is this was pretty much did this happen?
Yeah,
with other
or sort
books,
of or? Like try making it more like this. You know, and certainly that was a quite important book in my life. As for the character's Jewishness, I mean, I guess one thing I was aware of was that Roth had, you know, and many people had already sort of satirically sent up. Upper middle class Jewish suburbia in America, and that if I was going to do it, it had to also be a kind of new take on it, and you know that it couldn't be just this kind of like Borscht Belt shtick. It had to be, you know, 21st century Borscht Belt shtick
yes.
or something.
Yes.
And so that was certainly something I'm aware of. And actually, the chapter that sat at the synagogue, I think, was the hardest chapter for me to get right. And yeah. It's still the one part of the book that I think I don't love as much as many of the others.
Why was it so difficult for you?
I think just one thing was that one thing I knew is I really didn't want the book to be a complete satire.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted it to be funny, and I wanted it to sort of be poking fun of, you know, contemporary suburban life without being kind of cruel and without being sort of silly.
Yeah.
Or overly silly. And that was the hardest section to, you know, I wanted to sort of, although these characters are all kind of ridiculous and outrageous, I wanted them to all have some humanity.
Yeah.
And I think maybe because of just so much bitterness I had towards my own experience going to Hebrew school or something, I had a lot of trouble providing that to this synagogue and to the scene there. And
yeah.
And sort of, no matter how I wrote it, kept coming off as just really, you know...
caustic?
Yeah, in a way that didn't kind of fit the register of the rest of the book, I think. You know, because I, you know, the character just kept coming off as more disdainful than I wanted him to. And I don't know if I quite ever resolved that, but you know, I think that scene was important, and I think the religion is important in the sense that, you know, the book is about this guy who feels very kind of spiritually vacant.
Yeah.
And vacant in terms of feeling like, you know, some kind of connection to anything is something that he's looking for. And, you know, I wanted that to come early in the book as kind of, as sort of to set up the spiritual vacancy that's a part of his larger world and a part of his larger community. And that, you know, religion isn't providing, you know, and his family's not providing, and nothing seems to be providing.
Yeah.
And I think it's funny in that way, you know, the one character who I do see as, you know, having this kind of, you know, roundabout spirituality, and the character that Eli seeks out is Khan, who's his his sort of mentor, who's a very troubled guy. And
Was he always handicapped, or was there?
Yeah,
a point?
He was always handicapped. Okay. I think, you know, I mentioned Bello, but you know, when I first set out for the book, one idea I had was sort of to make it this kind of contemporary version of The Adventures of Augie March, and it didn't turn out that way at all, which is definitely for the better. But the two things that sort of stayed were, you know, this idea of this handicapped, troubled mentor who is Einhorn in Augie March and who is Khan in that book. So that was sort of, I kind of based the character on him. And I based Benji, Eli's older brother, on Simon, who's Augie's older brother in Augie March. So those were the two things that stayed from that.
It's so bizarre because I'm doing this silly modern library reading challenge, and of course the book I happen to be reading right now is Augie March.
Oh,
so it's like, you know, we're on the same page. But actually this leads me to ask you whether the Boston you created for this book, or the Boston suburb you created that was entirely fictitious, whether that even has the heft of the Chicago that's in Augie March. I mean, I learned from a rather obsessive hyperlinked oriented entry from a man named Matt Corley that Newton, where you grew up, is a Boston suburb. It was named the fifth safest city in America among cities with a population between 75,000 and 100,000 in 2010. It has actually been safe for some time. So this leads me to ask a number of questions. One, well, is Newton dangerous in any sense? And two, how do you as a novelist who want to write about an area like Newton, what do you do to pad it out? I mean, you know, you have ZLX, the radio station, the classic rock station. You mentioned Boston's nonsensical public transit system, but it's pretty much based off of little notions like this. So, you know, is location difficult for you, or was this something that was there in the previous draft, or what else?
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the most fun things I had with writing the book is sort of writing my hometown, but with the freedom to make stuff up and exaggerate things and change things. You know, that, you know, I thought about setting it in the town where I actually grew up, but I just thought it would be more fun, you know, give me a lot more creative freedom to kind of put, you know, geographically put things next to each other and, you know, make up names of stores and stuff like that. And that was really fun. But at the same time, it's, you know, it's very much based on on the town I grew up in. And I think actually one of the reasons, you know, this became a novel rather than in some ways, you know, some of my stories, is that I felt one thing I knew was that I sort of wanted to really have this larger setting that I can kind of explore quite fully and have people move around an area and, you know, show different parts of the city. So that was really fun.
Even though you contained him in the basement for a good chunk of
it,
and contained him in interior locations.
Yes,
and
certainly he can't drive, so he has a lot of trouble getting around.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like that. But I, you know, you do see some different basements. There's a lot of people in the book have basements. So, you know.
Is that really a Boston thing where everyone has basements?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I spent my adolescence doing bad things in basements. So I think my sort of first, all of my first, you know, alcohol, drugs, sex experience all took place in basements. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of basements, I got to say that for an overweight and unappealing young man, or rather an interesting, unappealing young man, Eli does get around. You've got Allison Gee at the beginning, the young woman passing time who moaned or fake moans or maybe just coughed. You have the business with the married woman. We see early on that Eli has these lustful aspirations towards Jennifer Estes, this person who he looks through Facebook and sees that she smiled seductively like she didn't know we were separated by glass and she was made purely of pixels. So I have to ask you, sir, how does such a pathetic man have such an active, gregarious sex life?
Well, I think he's having sex with other very pathetic people.
Yeah. Pathetic people hook up.
Yeah. You know, he has sex, I think, 3 times in the book, and the book's 326 pages long, so that's, you know, a little...
One climax every 100 pages.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
That's not bad. But at the same time, I think I just, you know, maybe some of it is slightly... You know, maybe they're both the women he sleeps with are a little out of his league, but I sort of felt like I wouldn't want to read a book that doesn't have a sex scene at least every 100 pages.
I see.
So I better
that's
put
that's
one
the
in.
Roth influence again.
Yeah. And, you know, I also thought, I think, you know, one, you got to throw this guy a bone every once in a while.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it's not like he's having this great sex most of the time. It's usually just sex as a path to further humiliation and misery. So, you know.
It's also a nice break from all the drug-based humiliation.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, you know, throwing humiliation at a protagonist like this, does this allow you to love him more? Does it allow the reader to love him?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think if you're reading... you know, characters who are just really good looking and like having, you know, amazing sex with like Victoria's Secret models, like I just kind of hate them.
Yeah.
Just like, fuck you. Like asshole. Yeah. I don't want to read about that.
Yes.
I'll just get bitter and jealous. But you know, I relate
there's two types of readers. The reader who reads for this kind of romantic fantasy of someone who's better looking than, and then there's the one who wants to read someone who's worse than them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, yeah, I mean, like a fan's notes is a good example of that.
But how low can you go?
You know, I root for that guy. It's like, yeah, our lip sites guys are all really pathetic.
Yeah, or Martin Amis or something like that. Yeah, yeah.
Although Amis, I think, is, he can be so cruel to his character. He can be so cruel to the guy, you know, there's always like, well, in some of his books, like I guess in Money, like John Self is just this, he's so cruel to him, but you feel like he is Amos and you kind of, even though he's...
Yeah, but John Self is a bastard.
Yeah, he's a bastard.
He is one of the most irredeemable characters, but it's so fascinating to see how the guy actually thinks and, you know, how he treats women is terrible, but it's like, how can a man like that continue, you know?
But in other, like in Dead Babies or in Success, he like chooses these kind of weaklings.
Yeah.
Like these kind of, what's his name from Piggy from Lord of the Flies type figures. who aren't the main character. They're sort of the secondary character, and he just tortures them.
Yeah.
And just never lets them win anything. And I feel terrible for him. Amos is just cruel.
Yeah, He's so cruel. But it's very funny. But I mean, how cruel can an author be? How cruel can you be as an author, do you feel? I mean, do you feel that you need to push into a maximum amount of cruelty? Or what?
No, I try not to be too cruel. I think I just, I think all the sort of trouble that's, everything that goes wrong for Eli is somehow, it doesn't feel cruel to me. It feels like Eli trying to tell the world has shat on me. And this is why I'm like this. It's not my fault or something. And, I feel like Eli in some ways is, I don't think he's an autobiographical character in the sense I grew up in a very different type of family from him. And, he has hair, which I don't have.
I don't have it much either, right, so there you go.
And, things like that. But at the same time, I feel like he's sort of an exaggeration of how I felt as an adult, when I was his age about the world. And one thing, I remember is so much just wanting people to kind of understand that, I've turned out this fucked up way because all this other stuff happened and it's not my fault. I think he's really kind of trying to scream that from the treetops and almost justify his own pathetic existence rather than, I didn't feel like I was being cruel to him. I just sort of felt like I was trying to, endear the reader to him by showing the reader that the world hasn't been very nice to him sometimes, even though on the surface he has this very kind of easy existence.
Sure. You alluded earlier to sort of going through a rough period while writing this book, or shortly before it, and you also mentioned that, the football field thing didn't happen to me.
No.
I hate to ask a cliched question about, writing as catharsis, but I am wondering if Eli served almost as an alter ego to some degree to sort of show you the worst case scenario, similar to what we're talking about here, of how one can live or what one should go through or something like this to sort of help you kind of climb out of this tough spot.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think, I think in some way, like Eli, high school left kind of a very bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah.
I think there's a Kurt Vonnegut once said, I think, in America, high school never ends.
Yes.
And, I think in some ways writing this book was cathartic in the sense that it was sort of my attempt to end high school and to stop thinking about it and to stop sort of feeling shitty about the fact that I didn't get laid very often when I was a teenager.
It's the one every 100 pages. Now we know the real reason.
Yeah. So, and to kind of put this in the past, and I think, I started writing it when I had moved back in with my parents at one point. And I was,
oh, really?
I was very,
very method writing there.
Yeah. Although, almost all of it was written after I'd then later moved out again. But that was certainly, an inspirational period for the book. And I did kind of feel like, in some ways it was, and also trying to, I think, make sense of, experiences I'd had in the suburbs and in, my life and in high school and after high school. And, There's one of my favorite moments in Sam Lipsight's in Venus Drive, in one of the stories, when these two guys from their hometown meet later on in their lives and they're both drug addict. One's a drug dealer and one's a drug addict, and they're both sort of in pretty bad shape living in New York, and they're talking about their hometown, and one says something like, We both got out, which often is kind of the idea of these stuck in the hometown books, is that you get out in the end, or you somehow leave and you go to New York and then everything's all right. But these two guys had left and gone to New York and were in worse shape than they had been in before. And there's
the
a line like,
the new, you know, you can't go home again. You know?
Yeah, and he says something like, you know, getting out wasn't the problem.
Yeah.
You can imagine what the problem was.
Yes, yes.
I don't really know where I was going with
no,
that.
No. That's totally... I mean, maybe another way to also talk about Eli was the fact that, you know, one of the saddest aspects of his cooking, for example, is that he cooks alone. He's, like, making Moroccan chicken and the like, and he's, you know, making other stuff, and nobody's actually eating with him. It's, you know... The other curious question...
That's very autobiographical.
Well, really?
I spent a lot of time alone, I'd say, in the years, you know, from college until sort of the last few years. And, you know, lived alone in various apartments, and... Even when I was living with my parents, you know, and I was really, really into cooking.
Yeah.
I had mono my freshman year of college and pretty much spent a year watching the Food Network and learned to cook. And no one else in my family is really into food at all.
Really?
And I got, you know, and I would make, especially in this year when I was living alone at my parents, you know, I was living at my parents' house, back at my parents' house, and I just, you know, would cook these really elaborate meals and no one would really care. And then... When I first moved to New York, I lived alone in three different apartments, and would just cook. I would just like spend my nights on these cooking projects, and then eat them by myself, and it was pretty depressing. So,
but you know what's also curious, man, is that Mrs. Sachs even says that she's a terrible cook. She's hoping Eddie can come over and cook for her. None of the women in this book cook, and I thought that was really interesting. Is this also a personal reflection? Is this the way it is in Boston?
I don't know if it's Boston, but I feel like in my generation, maybe, or it does seem to me these days that men are really into cooking. And that, you know, I know a lot of men who cook all the meals in there, you know. I pretty much, my girlfriend almost never cooks.
Yeah, mine too,
You know, I do all the cooking.
Do you have like a sort of arrangement where you do the cooking so you don't have to do the dishes? Because that's really one of the incentives for me.
Yeah, we have various arrangements. She does almost everything else. And I do the cooking and take out the cat shit. Those are pretty much my two jobs.
Hopefully not at the same time.
No. And she does everything else. I think that's our arrangement.
Would you say these gender lines are more based around people who live in urban or suburban settings that are close to places like Boston and the like? Or
maybe.
I feel like
cooking has become kind of this like masculine sport that, you know,
Iron Chef, there you go.
Yeah, like the Iron Chef and people like, you know, Mario Batali and Emeril have kind of made cooking into this really... kind of manly act, and that, you know, I know a lot of guys who are like really into meat and like got these huge knives and love like cutting into bone and you know, stuff like that.
It's sort of like the new toolkit because now kitchen utensils are just as elaborate as a run to Home Depot.
No, I think that's definitely true. I think, you know, my generation of guys is really into cooking for some reason or not, for that reason maybe. You know, I think maybe people are also just very into food, or at least in the part of Brooklyn that I live in.
Yeah.
People take their food very seriously.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I also wanted to ask, I know that you took a long time to get an agent, and that it was 5 years to write this book. I'm curious why... You know, if you could just talk about this a little bit, why did it take a long time? Did that 5 years include any revisions you got from an agent who basically said, hey, I think you have a voice, but maybe it's not cutting it for me?
Yeah, it had some of those.
How many rejections did you get?
Well, I didn't even actually start looking for agents until, like, the fifth year. I had an earlier period. An agent had sort of found me very early on in the process.
Your stories?
Based on a story of mine. And then I had finished a draft of the novel during my first year of Columbia for that agent. And then the agent was sort of ready to go out with it, which in retrospect, you know, I'm really, really glad he didn't. But, you know, kind of told me at the last minute that the agency wasn't having much success selling fiction, and it was a new agency, and that maybe, you know, they
we want you on board, but we suck at our job.
Yeah, they sort of, you know, not quite like that, but they were sort of like, well, you know, we'd understand if you wanted to try to find somewhere else. And so then I thought, huh, maybe that's a good idea. And then I talked to some other agents, and you know, I met with one agent who was really interested but had some really what I thought were terrible ideas about the book.
Yeah.
And then I kind of, you know, thought I need to work on this book more. And then I went a few more years and just did many drafts and didn't send it out to any agents for a long time. And, you know, I finished Columbia and it was my thesis. And then, you know, I took edits from my thesis readers and then I did another draft and then I send it back to Sam, and he gave me more edits, and then I did another draft, and you know, eventually, sort of, you know, a couple years after I finished my MFA, I you know, felt like it was at this point ready to that it, you know, I was happy with it, and I was ready to send it out, and I did, and you know, I just sort of sent it to like every agent, I don't know, however many agents.
Are we talking like several dozen or a handful?
No, probably
or?
Like, maybe like 20.
Yeah.
Some I didn't hear back from, most rejected it. A few were sort of like, I really like this, but it'll never sell. That was kind of I was either getting that or I was getting, this character is just too unlikable, I can't relate to him.
Yeah.
Which now I hear lots of people saying on the internet, but blew my mind and continues to, because I just think he's so likable and like such a nice guy. I don't know.
Yeah.
But people really, you know, I don't know. People, I think, get frustrated that he just can't get his shit together.
Yeah. well, let's get into this since we've brought it up now twice, and I think you need to get this off your chest clearly.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, the Goodreads reviews. I mean, I discussed this issue with Cynthia Ozick. She was complaining to me about Amazon reviewers who basically say a book's not good because they don't like the character. I looked at some of the Goodreads reviews because I saw your Twitter feed and I saw you bitching about them. And I'm like, okay, I got
to
see what's up here, right?
Maybe I shouldn't bitch about it.
And I saw a similar situation where, oh, the book's funny, but I don't like the character. I'm wondering, you know, what does this say about the present state of American fiction if we like the books but don't like the characters, and, you know, novelists such as yourself or Cynthia Ozick are essentially under the gun from a mob of fastidious Goodreads reviewers who want to have their views of the world confirmed by fiction. You know, how do you get through this? And what do you do? What do we deal with? Is this a temporary phase? Has Goodreads created an additional problem for the latitude of literature?
I don't think it's, you know, I don't mean to blame Goodreads or think any of this is Goodreads' fault or that it's necessarily anyone's fault. I think just, you know, most books are going to, you know, most books don't appeal to these incredibly broad and wide audiences for a variety of reasons. And I think most, you know, throughout history, most, and maybe, you know, it's even less so now, but most sort of serious literature isn't going to be liked by everyone.
Yeah.
You know, I think if there were if Goodreads existed during like Kafka's time, there would be, you know, he would not do well. He would
or
get a lot of
Wake for that
stars.
Matter. Yeah.
Either of those guys, you know, like, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, if, you know, imagine, like, the Goodreads reviews of The Castle or something. Like, but or even a book like Lolita when it first came out.
I don't like the fact that he sleeps with...
exactly. But, you know, I think the bigger problem in some ways is that, you know, the state of publishing, such as it is, you know, and the fact that sort of so much of reading has been replaced by television and the internet and video games and movies is that publishers are sort of so afraid to take on anything that's not, you know, that doesn't have this kind of mass appeal that is kind of, you know, taking on the risk that some people might not like it or find it offensive.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the other thing is that, you know, at the same time, there's so many more now than ever, these kind of small independent houses that have really kind of picked up the slack of what the big houses, you know, aren't aren't publishing or ignoring for all these various reasons, because it's too experimental, because it's too, you know, because the characters are too unlikable, because whatever reasons. And, you know, that, you know, that literature is all still there and exists in the world. And I think the people who are into it, you know, are still finding it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's not so different in some ways from even like Fitzgerald never really, you know, was a total commercial failure, for most of his life.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was actually an indie press, technically, I guess, which was the U.S. military who brought The Great Gatsby back into print and sort of, you know, got people liking it again. So I don't know, you know, the books get lost and found. And I think, you know, I think maybe some of this reaction to my book is that, you know, maybe it was, I think it seems to have been marketed really well. And you know, a lot of people are reading it who probably wouldn't have read it. And maybe don't like it because they're reading it, a book that like got marketed to them that maybe, you know, might not have been normally or something, you know.
But wait a minute, Adam. At the head of this conversation, we were basically suggesting that the people on Goodreads were improved Renaissance men over the TV watchers.
True.
Or more informed readers.
True. I mean, I think there are also really informed readers on the internet.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess I think, you know, at least some of the negative Goodreads reviews I've gotten have felt like they've come from, you know, some of them I think, you know, maybe are informed and make great points, but
yeah.
Although I'm not quite ready to concede that yet, but
of course, it's still young. But
I do think there's, you know, there are people, it seems like, negative reviewers on all sorts of, on Amazon, on Yelp, on whatever, everything who...
They review books on Yelp?
Not books, I'm saying reviews of almost everything that sort of come from people who are negatively reviewing a product for being a different product from the one they thought they were getting.
Yeah.
I remember my dad, who's a writer, you know, one of his books of stories, you know, has this terrible Amazon rating because there are like five reviews essentially saying, I ordered this book thinking it was a different book with the same title.
Yeah.
And it's this one, and it's not the book I wanted. One star.
Oh, God.
But this book's kind of okay anyway.
Yeah,
but,
you
know, I feel like, you know, that, you know, in some way, you know, at least some of the criticism I've gotten was like, the blurb said this book was really funny, but it's actually really sad, and I wanted it to be, like, just funny and not sad. And so, you know... I don't know.
Victim of the blurbs there.
Yeah, you know, I kept thinking, like, no, it's supposed to be sad.
Yeah.
Like,
but, I mean, to a certain degree, you as the writer can't help what marketing teams and audiences
are
going to do.
No, of course not.
But, I mean, you know, on the other hand...
No, I think, as I said, the book was marketed really well, and I think a lot of people who wouldn't have probably picked it up if it said, like, this book is about a miserable person who never leaves his bed and ends up, you know, pretty unhappy, but...
I've got some
tiny bit of hope, maybe.
But I do have to say, I mean, you know, you did work as a bookseller at Book Court for a while, so it's not like you're unfamiliar with this sort of strange relationship of trying to sell a book to someone or something like this. I mean, you know, should this surprise you, some of these reactions to Goodreads,
really?
No, it
doesn't surprise me at
all. Just sort of just annoys you, basically.
Just annoys me.
Okay.
No, it's funny. I mean, when I worked at the bookstore, you know, I really, you know, I loved working in a bookstore, and I think I also, you know, found it miserable for a lot of other reasons. But I did.
Well, like how, such as what?
Well, like, you know, I think people kind of romanticize the idea of working in bookstores, and I, you know, I had a great experience there, and I met so many writers, and I got cheap books, and that was all fantastic. But it's also still like, you know, a job that pays $10 an hour and that you occasionally, you know, have to, like, mop up child's vomit from the floor and, you know, spend hours unpacking boxes and stuff
physical
like
labor
that.
And all
so,
that,
you know, I think, you know, I'd be careful to sort of, to say it's like, you know, this, it's kind of like this, oh, this sort of working class fantasy of the, you know, of the bourgeois college kid to like slum it for a couple years and work in a bookstore or something. But, you know.
The same might also be argued of novelists as well.
Sure,
people think that they make far more money than they do.
Yeah,
people,
exactly.
Or literary journalists.
right. Yeah. But, you know, I think, you know, I was also, I often got very frustrated because I sort of, I think I did have this idea that everyone, if I just gave everyone Homeland by Lipsight, like, they would all love it. And it was just a matter of putting the book in people's hands. And then I would give it to people, and they didn't get it. And I'm like, you know, I'd like work really hard to be like, you are gonna love this book, like it's the best. And then you sort of realize that, like, actually, you know, a lot of these books, most people, you know, it takes a certain reader. I remember, you know, when, you know, recently Ben Lerner's novel Leaving the Atosha Station, which was you know, my favorite book of this year. I thought it was just absolutely brilliant, and you know, recommending it to people, but sort of realizing that, like, really only a few people are actually gonna like this who I give it, and you know, feeling, you know, I remember having this moment where I was like, this book should be the number one bestseller in America, and like everyone of my generation should read it, and you know, why isn't this reviewed in the Times and all this stuff. But at the same time, I, you know, thinking more about it, it is a book that I think will probably only appeal to a small audience, and maybe that's, you know, and that's okay. That's, you know, I don't think all things need to, but you know, and then you find other books that you know, everyone for whatever reason or another does seem to really like, and you know, you can recommend people those books in the bookstore, but and then there's also this great feeling of, like, you know, finding someone looking for a book who, you know, doesn't really know what they want, and then you, you know, and then you give them something, you know, like a fan's notes. That, you know, that was another one I kind of, you know, slipped to a lot of people, and you know, if I thought they were someone who might like it, and then they come back and you know, loved it, and they you know, they, and it opens up this whole new world, and that's like the best thing, you know, and the best feeling. So,
but what are the stuff goes both ways? We're talking about two levels of audience: the general audience that is going to want something that, you know, that is more fantastical, I suppose, and the audience that will read your book or will read a fan's notes or will read Homeland and the like. I mean, you know, do you have any ideas on how to expand the second category of audience, or I mean, you know, or is this just going to be the case for these kinds of books, for your kind of book?
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, the only way to expand that audience, I think, is just have more people, you know, sort of enthusiastically working in bookstores and getting people to read these books, and you know, having publishers like Harper Perennial, I think, are doing a really great job of sort of, you know, taking kind of risky books and bringing them into the mainstream, or, you know, taking books by kind of young, you know, like Blake Butler and Justin Taylor and you know, bringing them to larger audiences. Yeah.
And Dennis Cooper and Marcin Dubansky.
Yeah, and Dennis Cooper and yeah, exactly. You know, all these people. And, you know, so I think both those things are happening. And the other thing I think is, in some ways, you know, people complain a lot about creative writing programs. I actually think, you know, the best thing about them, in one sense, is that it creates, you know, as there are more and more creative writing programs, it creates more and more readers of serious fiction, and I think, you know, that's sort of, that's really, really important, and I think any writer who complains about, you know, creative writing programs is really kicking themselves, because those are the only people who are buying your books, and
that's,
you know,
your audience.
Yeah, that is your audience, and you know, and
that's
and
like a Richard Nash talking point too.
Yeah.
Yeah,
is it?
Yeah, yeah. He basically says we want to cultivate the people who read books because they're also the people who buy books.
Right,
that's one of his big.
Yeah,
things.
Richard is a pal of mine.
Oh yeah,
we live down the street from each other. Yeah. I've had many. It's probably something I've had many late night discussions with him. Where he's gone on.
Yes, he does.
That
go
I guess
on.
Maybe I've taken in somehow. Yeah, no, I think it's true, and I think, you know, also creative writing programs, you know, people complain about how expensive they are, but they're literally funding writers' careers by making it so that we can teach.
Yeah.
And get paid even if no one's buying the books. So,
yes, exactly.
You know, I think they're really good things. And that, and I,
but was it,
and
wasn't
I think
it always
also,
the case, though?
I think they've also grown out of an educate, you know, in reaction to an education system that has really, you know, over the last however many, you know, 25 years or at least, sort of moved away from reading reading literature from, you know, towards reading critical theory instead of reading literature.
Yeah.
And, you know, towards sort of, you know, reading fiction, you know, for their, you know, to think about, you know, what, you know, to think about them in terms of social politics and, you know, the world economy and what, you know, yeah. and gender politics and all this stuff, and to sort of, you know, not read, you know, like you can't take lit classes in, you know, at least when I was an undergrad, and I, you know, I think that it's been like that for a while. You can't, you know, there are no classes on like American novels since 1950, or, you know, there are no classes on, you know, you don't read short stories pretty much at all in any lit classes in college. You know, in my class, I think there was one when I went to college, there was one class on Europe, on post-war European literature, yeah. You know, or 20th century European literature. And that was it. There was one class, and you cram in Kafka, Joyce, Thomas Mann, Virginia Woolf, and you read one book each, and that's it. And that's all you can take in your undergraduate career. So,
and that's it. Unless you decide to read more, yeah.
Right, exactly. And I think that actually is, and you know, I think even going back to high schools where, you know, no one's really reading, you know, the books you're reading aren't the types of books that are getting kids interested in literature, because, you know, I've always thought that, you know, high school curriculum should have contemporary literature, actually, and that, you know, that would sort of get kids reading. You know, you're still sort of reading really... I found the books I read in high school were much too difficult to be for my age at the time, and that, you know, I should have been reading maybe some easier, more contemporary stuff that would have, you know, excited me. So I think all these things are contributing, you know, as well as the sort of barrage of television, internet, and video games, to sort of the loss of readers. But I think in some ways, you know, what has come out to combat this are the creative writing programs and our sort of creative writing programs in undergraduate and teachers who, you know, enthusiastic teachers who do really care about the proliferation of literature and who are sort of, you know, slipping kids these kind of secret books that, yeah. you know.
Do you think that there should be a canon, or that it should really be about the secret books? This is something that interests me, and different writers have different takes on this. What's your take?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think there is sort of both, and that those things can coexist. Because there is a canon, but it's still kind of secret.
Yeah.
or something.
You have to sort of figure out the canon. Different people have different notions of what that canon is.
Yeah, yeah, different people
there are enough competing notions. Canons to
Yeah,
to
there
make
are many competing
move.
Canons. Yeah. But I think there is a kind of MFA canon to some degree that's different from the... You know, that's very different from the sort of, classical, you know, academic canon of literature, you know, that includes a lot of short story writers and that, you know, includes stuff that you know, you never read. Like, I feel like every, and I think the books do get to people, like, I think everyone sort of, you know, or every kind of aspiring writer has a teacher who, like, you know, gives them a copy of Jesus's Son and says, you know, check this out, but, like, you know, don't tell them I gave it to you because there's some really fucked up shit in here.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, and, you know, and that's a really fun thing, and it's a fun thing for me as a teacher to be able to, you know, share.
What books do you slip to your students?
What have I been teaching recently? I try to change it up. I'm now teaching undergrads, which I just started doing. But I have been teaching adults for a while. And especially adult New Yorkers, I give them all Grace Paley. I give them all Leonard Michaels, Isaac Bobble. And then, you know, sort of for my undergrads who really haven't read anything... I give them Amy Hempel, Dennis Johnson, Lipsight, you know, Carver, which most of them have never read, which I sort of always think they'll have read for some reason, because everyone has, but they've never, you know, they don't know anything about it. I don't know, David Foster Wallace, again, someone who's, you know, super famous, but they have no idea about. Just all sorts of stuff. But it's fun. It's fun to kind of, you know, go through and pick out stories and watch them read something. George Saunders, Barthelme.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of students who have read George Saunders and then have written stories in imitation of Saunders, and I'm like, oh, you must be reading so much Barthelme, and they've never heard of him. And then I've, you know, given them 60 stories, and they get really excited.
Yeah.
And it's great, and it's, you know. Sure. And, you know, I think a lot of, you know, I think the books always get in the right hands, hopefully, at some point. I don't know. I think I was lucky because my father was a writer, and you know, especially when I was younger and was sort of not very engaged with my family and kind of, you know, drifting into my own world of drugs and rock and roll and you know, being this rebellious teenager. My father kind of, you know, although he didn't want me doing drugs and you know, staying out until 3 a.m. and you know, doing whatever his biggest fears of what I was doing were, he did, you know, want to sort of maintain a relationship with me. And I think, you know, tried to do that really with books. And so he gave me all these books like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas or Bukowski, which now, of course, he like blames himself for giving them to me and giving me all these even worse ideas because I didn't even know about, you know, half the drugs in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And then, of course, wanted to try all of them. You know, but, you know, so from a pretty young age, I was sort of, you know, being given, you know, when I was in high school reading, you know, Hunter Thompson and Bukowski and, you know, the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test and Richard Brautigan and, you know, Barthelme, all sorts of stuff that my dad, you know, in this kind of attempt to sort of, you know, engage me. And you know, that, you know, I think I you know, did spend a lot of my younger life very kind of in my own world and you know, high a lot of the time and very disengaged from my family. And, you know, that was sort of this one way my father and I could, really connected through that time was through books.
Gotcha.
So, and you know, I think it was, you know, it was ultimately the one thing I ended up caring about enough in my life to sort of get my shit together in some way. So
I wanted to actually conclude this conversation with a very elaborate question that sort of relates to what you just talked about in terms of influence. And also what we were talking about at the very beginning, this, what I seemed is almost sort of like an interesting fusion between the Exley-like sentence, which is like laden with clauses, and the short, snappy sentence, more in the Lish Venus Drive-like mode, where it generally begins with a verb. You know, Gary Lutz has this 2008 piece.
Yeah, I know it well.
Yes, where he calls the type of sentence that he wants to write a complete portable solitude. You're dealing with a character here who is all about solitude. So I'm wondering, what is your ideal sentence, and how did these varying sentences come to be in this fusion? I mean, this may relate to what you were telling me earlier about how you had a massive draft and you were plucking things and trying to rearrange them. But I am curious about this. How did so many different sentences, short, snappy, Lish-like, and then, of course, ones with phrases such as, you know, Griffey Jr. set smiling with stiff-brimmed cap and laundered jersey. Totally different there.
Yeah, well, you know, I think they're different, but hopefully they're all sort of part of the same music.
Yes.
In some way. And you know, I think, you know, I don't think, you know, I think part of the answer is I really like, you know, a lot of the Lish stuff and a lot of these writers. And I love the, you know, I love that stuff, but I also, and I love the short, snappy sentence, but I also, you know, really love David Foster Wallace and DeLillo, who I guess is a Lish guy, and Elkin, you know, and Lipside, who I think does both as well.
Yes, he does.
And Elkin actually, I think, can really do both.
And Gil Carver, there's the great case of Lish.
Yeah, exactly. Or Gilbert Sorrentino was someone I was reading a lot when I was writing this book, who, you know, does the long sentence as good as well as anyone I can think of, and you know, I think to, you know, it, you know, it feels like, I guess one thing I was interested in with the language, which maybe gets to what you're saying, is that I feel like there's not much that happens in the book. And so I wanted, you know, in juxtaposition to that, the language to be very alive and sort of moving.
Yeah.
For it to move and dance and be playful. And that, you know, somehow this represents that although there's not much action happening and this guy's living a very kind of solitary existence, his inner life is quite kind of, you know, is quite alive and imaginative and, you know, all over the place.
How does this sense of the inner life, though, compete with the need to sustain dramatic action to advance the narrative? I mean, that's also, that can be problematic, especially when...
Well, I think, you know, there's not that much interiority in the book. I mean, there is, I think people, if you go through the book, there's not as much as you would think. And I actually think in some ways that the kind of music of the language in just describing action in, you know, him, you know, walking down the street or doing that, is a kind of its own representation of interiority, that, you know, and I think, you know, Lipsight, I think, is kind of the master at this, that if you look at his books, there's not, you know, the characters aren't stopping to think that much, but they're sort of thinking within, you know, the action, and the sentences themselves are sort of a commentary on the action without having an actual kind of commentary on it. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it does. I think what I'm trying to get at is, you know, to what level was it a struggle for you to find action when you were inhabiting this happy realm of the inner life? Well, I mean,
sure.
Which is not to say that it's bad, but I'm wondering if you had any specific struggle to compete with the need to advance the narrative or anything along those lines?
Well, like if you think of someone like Gary Lutz, who all the action is in the sentences themselves, and nothing happens in the stories. Although, actually, occasionally there are people like having sex with their sisters and stuff that that sort of gets slipped in there. Well,
by the way,
and then you know the other extreme would be, I don't know, someone like Richard Price, maybe, where you know it's all action and you know it's like dialogue and then things happening and you know, or probably there are more extreme examples, but that's maybe the extreme that I have read or something. I think I was sort of conscious of just trying to do something in between that and having, you know, knowing that I wanted this to be a sort of novel length work and that had to kind of sustain the reader with something other than just kind of fun fancy sentences. And you know, I'm also a person, you know, I also like long novels that have plots. You know, I think I'm really, you know, as a reader, I really enjoy both those things. I love Gary Lutz. You know, I also like reading books that, you know, have characters and a story and things happen in them. And, you know, I like sort of wanting to, you know, being curious about what's going to happen next. And, you know, I think both those things just kind of, you know, without even... it wasn't, you know, a conscious decision. I think it's more that just both those things contribute to my sensibility.